Good morning, everyone. Reggie, could you make me co-host? I'm gonna do a screen share. No, not yet.
But you may need to remove me as co-host. Maybe there can be. Okay.
I did. I removed you and I made Moshe co-host. Yeah.
Okay, great. Can everyone see that? Yes? Okay. This week's Parsha has in it perhaps one of the most poignant parts of the entire Torah, the story of the reunion of Joseph and his brothers. And the reason I'm bringing it up, because first of all, it's a beautiful thing to read, and people often think they know the story, but they really don't, and we see it in the text. Just to give you the last week's setup for this was that Benjamin, the youngest son, who had been brought down, is found to have the goblet, a divining goblet, of Joseph in his backpack, and he's thus arrested because he was accused of stealing it. And he has been imprisoned, and he says to the other brothers, okay, you guys can leave, but you have to leave Benjamin here. Okay. And this is really where the parsha begins. Vayigash elav. It's an interesting thing. Judah, and this is important to keep in mind, we know who Judah is. He was the one who said, don't kill Joseph, sell him into slavery. And he's also the one, if you remember in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, he's someone who basically has been taken in a good way by someone dressed in someone masquerading. Tamar masquerading as a prostitute. She then gets pregnant, and then he's able to fulfill his obligation because the sons he has sent to do the Levirate marriage with Tamar have all died. Okay. He comes close to him. He approaches him. Vayigash. It's a very strong word, Vayigash. And he says, please, my Lord, do you want me to read the Hebrew or we just go with the English? English, okay? Okay? You can read the Hebrew yourself, or I can read the Hebrew. You can read the English. It's up to you. I would do the English. Yehuda came close to him and said, please, my Lord, pray let your servant speak a word in the ears of my Lord. Can you imagine? He's now, there's Joseph. Whose Egyptian name is Safnat Paneach, right? Wearing all the royal robes, etc., sitting up probably on some sort of throne kind of thing, and he gets up and he goes close to him and whispers in his ear, and he says, "And we said, my Lord, we told you, the Lord had asked us earlier, do you have a father or another brother?" Which is a hint. The hint is that he's interested in finding out from Yehuda. And the question is Yehuda now aware somehow that by the questions he asked, is your father still alive? Is your brother still alive? That he's somehow more interested in their private life than would be expected of someone who's just official rank, etc. And as I said to my Lord, we have an old father and a young child of his old age whose brother is dead. Okay? Joe Joseph. So that he alone is left to his mother and his father loves him. And you said to your servants, bring him down to me. I wish to set my eyes upon him. But we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father. Were we to leave his father, he would die. If they brought Benjamin down, he would die. But you said to your servants, if your youngest brother does not come down with you, you shall not see my face again. Interesting that the insistence that he has on seeing Benjamin. Who is, by the way, his brother from Rachel, right? Who is the beloved one. Vayomer avinu shuv v'shivru lanu mat ochel. And our father said, return, buy us some food rations. But we said, we cannot go down if our younger brother is with us. Then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face if our younger brother is not with us. And then he says, now your servant, my father, said to us, you yourselves know that my wife bore two to me, one went away from me. I said, for sure he is torn to pieces, and have not seen him again thus far. Now, would you take away this one as well from my face? Should harm befall him, he will bring down my gray hair of ill fortune to Sheol. So now, when I come back to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, with whose life his own life is bound up, it will be that when he sees the lad is no more, he will die, and your servant will have brought down the gray hair of your servant, our father, in grief. For your servant pledged him for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back, I will be culpable for sin against my father all the days to come. So now pray, let your servant stay instead of the lad. Yehuda offers himself to be the hostage, if you will, but let the lad go up with his brothers. For how can I go up to my father when the lad is not with me? Then would I see all the ill fortune that will come upon my father. And at that point, we get the high note of the entire encounter. Velo yachol Yosef lehitapek. He could no longer restrain himself from the presence who were there, and he called out, have everyone leave me. So no one stood in attendance upon him when Yosef made himself known to his brothers. He put forth his voice in weeping, and the Egyptians heard, the Pharaoh's household heard, like all palaces, the ones who work for the king have their glass to the door. They want to know what's going on. And Yosef said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers were not able to answer him. They were terrified before him. And Yosef said to his brothers, pray, come close to me. And they came close, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, he says, do not be pained, and do not let upset be in your eyes that you sold me here, for it was to save life that God has sent me before you. For it is 2 years now that the famine has been in the midst of the land, and there is still another 5 years in which there will be no plowing or harvest. And God sent me ahead of you to make you a remnant on earth, to keep you alive as a great body of survivors. So now, it is not you that sent me here, but God. He has made me father to Pharaoh. Interesting term, father to Pharaoh. I will get to in a moment why that's an important line. And the Lord of all the household and ruler over all the land of Egypt, make haste, go up to my father, say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of Egypt. Come down to me, do not remain, and you shall stay in the region of Goshen. You shall be near me, you and your sons, the sons of your sons, your sheep, your oxen, and all that is yours. And I will sustain you there, for there are still 5 years of famine left, lest you be disinherited. Here your eyes see, as well as my brother Benjamin's eyes, that it is much that speaks to you. And then he goes on, and he, verse 14, he flung himself upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept, for he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After this his brothers spoke to him. The news was heard in Pharaoh's household. They said, Joseph's brothers have come. It's good in Pharaoh's eyes and the eyes of his servants. And Pharaoh said to Yosef, say to your brothers, do this, come to the land, fetch your father, etc. And when, and you have commanded, do this, take the wagons, etc., etc. And they did so, and they went back, and they bring his father down. There are some commentaries that say the reason he wants the father down is because he needs to have the father and the woman who raised him, Bilhah, because his mother Rachel was dead, to fulfill the dream that he had when he was a young man, that all of them shall bow down to him. So that dream had to be fulfilled. Okay. The reason I'm bringing it up, because this is a very emotional thing. And what I was interested in studying this is talk to the issue of what is self-discovery. What's being discovered here? What's being revealed here? And in connection with our practice, I said, what is it about the past? The past can't be changed, my friends. Okay, I'm going to leave this now. The past cannot be changed. However, and this is what we see, it's used a lot in therapy, people who are the therapists know what I'm talking about. You can't change the past, but you can reframe it. Reframe it. And what Joseph does is, in order to allow this encounter to be as emotional as it is, all this crying, you can imagine, all these grown men just hugging and crying with each other, which is such a sense of reconciliation, very similar to what Jacob had, if you remember, with his brother Esau, when he falls on his sword. So he says to them, and this is something that we often have to say to ourselves, my past may have been part of something larger that I did not understand. Right? This is one of the things that I hope we, when we get away from thought, And we get to just being. We begin to realize that all the thoughts that we had, all the construction of our past that we had, ultimately is a fleeting thing. It will go on because today will become yesterday, and tomorrow will be today, and it's all going to be basically a running, if you will, a calendar of life which continues on and on. So what does he discover? And that's what I was asking. What do we discover when we are in our practice? Well, essentially, the first thing we discover is that we're here. And it's now. And we're alive because we're breathing. Okay, so that's what we discover, that we have an aliveness within us. And that aliveness, of course, leads us to the possibility of some insight. And this is what. But I would suggest that what Joseph has discovered is not that he is indeed now who he is. He is the one who is. And look at the term he uses. He's got ego has not at all, changed since he was a young man. I am the father of Pharaoh. I am above Pharaoh. Pharaoh, Paparo, now is indebted to me because I saved the land, etc. And I would suggest that Joseph, his self-discovery is that he's no longer Joseph, in spite of the fact he says, "I am Joseph." He's no longer Joseph. He is this fellow called Safnat Paneach, who has become so powerful in Egypt. And because of his power in Egypt, he's able to do all the things that he does: bring the family down, give them a place to live, sustain them for 5 more years until the years of plenty. And ultimately, basically, he has been transformed. He's no longer Joseph, in spite of the fact that his and he was able to sort of fool his brothers quite a bit, and finally he reveals himself. Now, why does he reveal himself? He reveals himself in order to do what? I think ultimately he wants, but because of his question, he wants to see his father. Now, all the commentators all say, why did he not let his father know that he was alive? Could have sent a note, right? Could have sent a messenger. By the way, your son is still alive, etc., etc. Would have that alleviated so much of the grief of Jacob's life? And then they say, well, not only is he alive, but the younger brother, who is now the close, nafsho kshura b'nafsho, it uses the term, whose soul is connected to his soul, meaning that the bond between Benjamin and Yaakov is so tight that if you take it out, his life would end, basically. So when we work on self-discovery, matter of fact, I was looking up this whole thing. There is actually a motivational program that's used in some places that you may know about it. I know it's called the Joseph Effect. The Joseph Effect. How do you basically find your potential by self-discovery? How do you find what you really are capable of doing? How do you find that you can go into the future without being dragged into the past? And that's really a lot that we say in our meditation. We don't want to be living in regret. Regret doesn't get you too far because you can't change it. So this idea that he changed, that he really became someone else, we might say, oh, that's not true. He became Joseph and they're all singing Kumbaya, etc. I don't think so. I think he maintains his Egyptian status. And he knows that he could use that status for good. And then when he reframes the past, he says, guys, don't worry about your selling me. You did it because you're part of a greater plan, which you were not aware of. God sent me. You didn't send me into Egypt. God sent me to Egypt. And why? Because there was this great catastrophe that was coming. And because of it, I was able to save you and save the world. This is the way Joseph's mind is. He's a grandiose thinker. I saved the world, right? And because of that, I have the capacity to save you, the family, as well. I was looking at something from Shefa Gold, and she talks a little bit about this issue as well. I'm just going to try to get it up here for a second. Hold on. Okay. So here it is. I just wanted to get it right. So, before I get to Sefer Gold, I found this also a very interesting comment by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Alav Shalom, who talks about the fact that in our tradition as Jews, and other traditions as well, we're constantly retelling stories. Stories is the way we offer our faith. By telling stories, and what we do each time we retell the story is we somehow emphasize different things as we come to it. That people interpret things very radically in a way, like the rabbis did, and the mystical commentators, etc., etc. They take the text, they take the story, and they say, how does the story apply to my now? And not only is it relating the past, what is the now? And that's the way we study Torah. We study the Torah by saying, yes, the Torah is, quote unquote, primordial. Before the beginning of creation, God looked into the Torah to create the world. But when it comes to us telling the stories, we tell the stories about ourselves. And this is a great power that we don't have to necessarily go back and take things literally, but we can enhance things by our own a sense of reality. And our sense of reality is what are these stories and what do they mean to me? Because that ultimately is very helpful. If you say that. So I'm going to just get to another piece by Rabbi Gold, and she does a beautiful job. Hold on one second. Rabbi Gold, in her wonderful book, A Torah Journeys, she says this. First of all, there's a wonderful story of how she says, how did Jacob learn about what went on with this reunion? And according to a wonderful source about a woman you should know about, Jacob had a granddaughter, a favorite granddaughter named Serach Bat Asher. Asher was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. This was his daughter. And she was, and this I think why Rabbi Gold was very fascinated with this, because Serach, this woman, was a musician with a gentle voice and a powerful spirit. Her songs were a healing balm for Jacob during his dark nights of wrestling. Whenever he called for Serach, she sang for him and he was comforted. And it was agreed that only Serach would be able to reveal this great news, because when Jacob's soul, overcome by blessing, flew out, Serach would be able to sing a song that would call his soul back to this world. What a wonderful thing. She can call his soul back to this world. And the song that Serach sang to Jacob was the most beautiful melody she had ever sung. Everyone had heard it, wept with joy, because it is Joseph's spirit was revealed. The melody carried Joseph's beauty, pain, longing, love, and devotion. Her words told the story of his journey and was woven with his dreams. And Sarah's song also told the truth about the whole family, a truth that would have been hard to hear if would not delivered with such purity. So we, like Jacob, she says, will remain ignorant of the great blessing, the miracle of life itself, unless we can receive that blessing in beauty. The truth of our lives will remain mute and invisible unless it becomes a song. The vast miracle of our existence would be overwhelming if received unadorned and all at once. It would tear us open, and our souls set free would fly. Yet artful glimpses of that same vast miracle gradually expand our capacity to know the truth. The spiritual challenge that we share with our father Jacob is to prepare ourselves to listen for the song of truth, the song of truth and blessing, and let its beauty call us to deeper living. So all the spiritual challenge, Rabbi Gold says, and blessings of Vayigash, this parsha, rest on a pivotal moment. The moment when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, he steps out from behind the mask of power, the mask of the false self, and weeps aloud. These are the tears of profound relief and of love unbound. This moment of expansion is the result of Joseph's embrace of a paradox. Two seemingly contradictory truths live inside Joseph, and when he can hold them both, when the true self is set free from artifice. And there comes a day, she says, and I'll conclude with this, that when both these perspectives exist at once, one that day of joy and anguish meet within us, and the resulting alchemical reaction explodes the boundaries of the false self, on that day we are set free, and this freedom allows us to come out of hiding to finally test the truth and reveal ourselves. Over the years, as you know, we've been talking a great deal, I've been talking a great, great deal, that one of the great challenges we have is to live with more than one idea in our head at the same time. Seems very hard for a lot of people. And this idea of living with, if you will, these two lives that he has, are basically what is that tension within him, which she claims, Rabbi Gold claims, is relieved by his revelation, by his self-discovery. But what is it that he discovers, as I said earlier? I think he discovers that these two things have to meet. One doesn't cancel out the other. The same way our pain and our joy are two opposites, if you will, of the same stick. You can cry of joy and cry of pain, but ultimately the cry is what unites it, this capacity of expressing it in an emotive way. So I would suggest that we deal with those things with ourselves. This is, I'm sure there are people who live, not this group excluded, of course, who live with a sense of their self having a false self. Some people call it the imposter complex. Am I really who I present myself to be? Is there something going on behind it that isn't really me, but I'm sort of, if you will, wearing a mask? That's really a great question. How do we unmask ourselves? First of all, to ourselves. That's the first place. And go through whatever anguish there is that I haven't lived a life of if you will, a truth. But we all fool ourselves to a certain degree. So that's the first thing. How do we remove the mask? And then how do we reconcile the two parts of our lives? I believe in our practice we have an opportunity. I know after a while when you practice long enough, you get to a place, hopefully, where you begin to examine all the things that are fleeting by you. It's a whole different thing. I'm not claiming everybody does it the same way. But you begin to say, why did that thought go by? Now, I know we're not supposed to poo-poo-poo-poo. We're not supposed to think about it. But how do we feel about it? I think there's an emotive thing that's going on when things go by. And we let them go by. We come back to our breath. We let it go by. We don't want to get stuck in that, in whatever kind of fantastic story we have created. We understand it's a story, we understand that it really is something that flows by, and we want to return to the now, to who I am right now. And even in saying who I am right now, am I sure that that's who I am right now? It's confusing, I understand. I'm confused, and I hope I'm sharing my confusion with you and to get you a little confused, because that's really an incentive to perhaps being less confused about things. So I want to open it up and just talk about the fact that we ever have moments of self-discovery. How has our practice helped us to be really who we are? Which I think is really the challenge. The challenge of Joseph was to be who he was, and he was stuck in this juxtaposition of having two lives. The life of Joseph, who went through so much turmoil, and then this life of extreme power, where he's able to help if you will, alleviate the turmoil that others are going to experience. So I'm working on this all the time. It's not a one-time thing. You don't just self-discover. You got to rediscover. You got to rediscover. Got to really dig in. And by digging into this capacity that we have to both reflect and to also have the capacity to, if you will, correct. And I think that the corrections that we're looking for are not because we will do our practice better, but how will we take that practice into the world? Can we create by our practice a sense of being authentic? Of being authentic? Can we let ourselves be ourselves without any kind of, if you will, a challenge to it? And there is a challenge to it. And again, it's because we have a thing called the self, and we have a thing called the ego, and we have ways of manipulating the past. Of course, we can frame it, but it's still the past. So I know this is something that perhaps they don't talk about a lot in our commentaries, our the Jewish commentaries on this, but what is the challenge we have of self-discovery? Some call this self-realization. That's another term that you can use. sort of a Maslow term, self-realization. But that is really what I think our prayer practice wants us to do. We want to basically get to a place where our self, which of course we have a lot of differences here between those of us who've been influenced by Buddhist practice and Buddhist ideas, but we still in Judaism, I think, have a need to have a self. We don't want to eradicate it. We don't want to eradicate ourselves even. Even in the deepest connection with the divine, our tradition says we're not absorbed into the divine. At best, we achieve dveikut, which means we can cleave onto the divine, maintaining our own sense of self. It's a different way of seeing things, and I think we have to always remember that we do a lot of work here trying to show comparisons with Buddhism and Judaism, but the bottom line, there are very, very essential differences, and we shouldn't try to hide those. And those differences have to do with our understanding of the world, of not being a place of misery and suffering only, but our sense of the world, that is tov ma'od, that the world is very good. And we have to take, if you will, our great strength from the fact that the world is good, and it's not necessarily only. Of course, it contains evil, it contains suffering, it contains pain, of course. But we really say that if we can rediscover, self-discover, that goodness within ourselves, that will put us in harmony with the universe. Because that's our mishigas as Jews. We really think it's possible to change. We really think it's possible to create a world where all of us will feel secure in knowing who we are, and especially in these very tough times, I think it's very important for us to emphasize much more our identity, who we are, and not necessarily be defined by the other, which of course is one of the things that anti-Semitism does for many Jews. It defines them. You may remember Jean-Paul Sartre's book, Anti-Semitism and the Jew, right, where he says, if it wasn't for anti-Semites, there wouldn't be any Jews. I could live without it for a while and see if that's the case. It would be interesting. But I don't think that's really a way to understand who we are and our own discovering those things within ourselves that really make a difference not only for our loved ones, but also for the entire world. Okay, I'll sign off now and open it up for you guys. The recording will stop. And the title, by the way, is Self-Discovery. Reggie, if you need a title for this, okay? So let's stop the tape.